Okay, folks, here's part two of our discussion of Ready Player One. Now, if you missed part one, you can go hear that on last week's episode. Or if you go to patreon.com/latenight, you can support us over there, see the video versions of this. We originally did it as a live stream, and you can see it over there. And also, lots more video episodes. We pretty much do a video episode every week, and sign up at any tier to get access to those. If you sign up at $5 a month or more, you get weekly mini episodes too. That's the kind of bargain. It's such a good deal. I almost feel bad for doing it. Almost. Enjoy the episode.
What's up? Are you Cox talking about Star Wars again?
It's better without you. What's up?
It is.
You Cox talking about Star Wars again?
It's the funniest line in the whole book.
It's very, yeah, absolutely. Go off, Queen.
Thank you. Oh my God. Let's see.
Once again, I am an ally.
Oh my God. So true. So chapter 14 is where, recapping, Wade and H and Artemis have all gotten through the first gate and they have their keys and they're trying to figure things out. Meanwhile, the Suxors over at IOI are sending their army to try to get through the gates and cheat. And so the CEO, Nolan Sorrento of IOI, comes to Wade with a proposal. And he brings them to their evil headquarters where they're cheating and they sit in a boardroom. And the Sorrento is like trying to bribe him to be like, work for us and you'll get, you know, millions of dollars and we'll help you. You'll have all of our resources, blah, blah, blah. And then Wade's like a really cool guy and says, actually, I held up a hand, cutting him off again. I've spent the last few seconds thinking this over a bit more, and I'm going to have to pass on your offer. I think I'd rather find the egg on my own, thanks. I stood up. You and all the other Suxors can all go fuck a duck.
Oh, yeah, fuck a duck. Yes. I really, to be fair, I love the phrase fuck a duck as an insult. Go fuck a duck. It's awesome. Great.
It's so badass. And even the book calls out how badass it is. Sorrento began to laugh, a long, hearty laugh that I found more than a little disturbing. Oh, you're good. That was so good. You really had us going there, kid. When his laughter tapered off, he said, that's the answer I was expecting. So now let me give you our second proposal. And this is like more money. And Wade says no again. And so this is the most. Then Sorrento was like, all right, I have a.
You shall betray me three times.
A third offer. Your first instinct right now might be to log out. Oh, right. He says that he's going to blow him up, that they're going to kill him if he doesn't join them. Your first instinct right now might be to log out and make a run for it, Sorrento said. I urge you not to make that mistake. Your trailer is currently wired with a large quantity of high explosives. He pulled something that looked like a remote control out of his pocket and held it up. And my finger is on the detonator. If you log out of this chat link session, you will die within a few seconds. Do you understand what I'm saying to you, Mr. Watts? So that brings me to our final proposal. Sorrento rubbed his hands together excitedly, like a kid about to open a present. Tell us how to reach the first gate, right now, or we will kill you, right now.
Or we will kill you.
And then he keeps villain monologuing. No, Wade. I'm not. Mm-hmm. Think about it. With everything else that's going on in the world, do you think anyone will care about an explosion in some ghetto trash rat warren in Oklahoma City? They'll assume it was a drug lab accident or maybe a domestic terrorist cell trying to build a homemade bomb. Either way, it will just mean there are a few hundred less human cockroaches out there collecting food vouchers and using up precious oxygen. No one will care, and the authorities won't even blink. That's a nice villain that you wrote, Ernest Cline. Very subtle. Really just excellent characterization. Great work. He's going to call people cockroaches. Mm-hmm. That's
very human is what I would say about Nolan's.
Yes.
Seems like a real guy.
And then, of course, Wade takes a stand. Sorrento, I said, trying to hide the fear in my voice. I want you and your bosses to know something. You're never going to find Halliday's egg. You know why? Because he was smarter than all of you put together. It doesn't matter how much money you have or who you try to blackmail. You're right. Going to lose.
Which is why Halliday was so smart that he allowed for the very real possibility that the richest people in the world would find his treasure first and take over the, you know, his darling oasis. Can we talk, by the way, about how Wade's initials spell wow?
I didn't make that connection. What a devious clue. So he's like, you're bluffing. Bye-bye. Also worth noting that Wade is not in the trailer.
I really like that. Bye-bye. We're going to gif that because it was a very, very good image.
Thanks. You know, yeah. I'm just
good delivery
running with the 80s school bully.
Yeah, very, very Gen X.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. So Wade's like, you're bluffing. And Sorrento doesn't know that Wade's actually in a van like a mile away in his little gamer hole. He comes out of it and he's like, oh, boy, that was a crazy bluff. I was pulling my gloves back on when I heard the explosion. I felt the shockwave a split second after I heard the detonation and it instinctively dropped to the floor of my hideout with my arms wrapped over my head. In the distance, I could hear the sound of rending metal as several trailer stacks began to collapse, ripping free of their scaffolding and crashing against one another like massive dominoes. Remember dominoes?
You mean that popular toy from the 80s?
These horrific sounds continued for what seemed like a very long time. Then it was silent again. And so this little fucker runs back to where he lives to confirm that hundreds of people have just been killed in a strike meant to kill him. He shows almost no emotional reaction.
He's got things to do.
Yeah, the extent of it is...
Hundreds of people have died. Yeah.
Eventually, the shock began to wear off and the reality of what had just happened started to sink in, which, Ernest, that's a great way to transition between plot points in your story. Really good job. My Aunt Alice and her boyfriend Rick were dead, along with everyone who had lived in our trailer and in the trailers below and around it, including sweet old Mrs. Gilmore.
And above? Also above, right?
Yeah.
What, anyway.
Including sweet old Mrs. Gilmore.
Can we just say, the idea of fucking stacking trailers is the dumbest thing of all
time.
Yes,
let me finish the quote.
We just blew by that. Okay, fine.
Including sweet old Mrs. Gilmore. And if I had been at home, I would be dead now too. Yeah, well, fuck all these other people. I could have died, but I didn't. So everything's fine. I'm going to log back on. Oh, Christ.
Yep. Can we skip to the zero gravity dance sequence? Or do you have anything before that where a 75-year-old man DJs in a wizard costume?
And it's the coolest thing ever.
And it's the coolest thing you've ever seen, including the line, I wasn't much for dancing or for socializing with the twinked out wannabe Gunter Uber dorks. Here we are with the fucking twink
again,
thing. What are you talking about?
It's really interesting, the words that you use to describe people that you don't like. Bipolar,
but
twinks.
But I don't think he's using twink the way... I don't know what he thinks that word means. Twinked out? What does that mean? I don't know what it means.
I don't think that word means what you think it means. Another sick reference.
Oh, Leighton, you did it. You out-referenced... Who references the referencer?
Right? That's another reference. Mm-hmm.
It's a meta reference.
In the interim, Wade is famous because he's at the top of the high score list for being the coolest gamer around.
He is described as a god.
Yes.
At one point, right?
People clap for him. My new status is a world famous Gunter.
An Uber Gunter, even.
Let me try that again with a straight face. My new status as a world famous Gunter gave me all kinds of underworld credibility, which helped me get access to a highly exclusive illegal data auction site known as the...
Ready? Say it.
The Elite Haxor's Wares House. And for a shockingly small amount of money, I was able to purchase a series of access procedures and passwords for the USCR database. And so he fakes an identity. He's a new guy now. Mm-hmm. Rich says, got me fiending for Twink Gunt. Oh God.
That's very funny, Rich.
Talk about your or actually that I have this like all this shit that's highlighted that it's him, Wade and Artemis, like I'm gonna put flirting in heavy air quotes.
Yeah.
Which for Wade is, are we going to have an online romance? Crosses fingers.
Oh my God. He is such a fucking creepo with this girl. Like he is not letting it drop. And his, like, the hitting on her or the flirting or whatever that he's doing fucking sucks.
Yeah, wait, okay, actually, can
it's
you...
It's so bad.
Can you get to... Because I want to read their chat logs and I want you to be Parzival and I want to be Artemis. And there's a certain section.
Oh, yes, please.
It's on page 170.
But I think the thing I want to... Oh, yeah, okay, the thing I want to read is after.
Yes, 170. I know, that's right. I know my chronology of this book.
Okay. I tried not to. Hold on. Okay, here we are. Yes, we're not reading this whole thing, though.
No, there's just a segment. The first part is the Parzival saying that's because most Gunters are male.
And you want me to be Parzival with, starting with that?
Mm-hmm. So everybody, this is the charming romance between our two leads. And this is after like three pages of him hitting on her and it's not going great.
Badly, yeah. That's because most, this is a text exchange, by the way. They're like basically IMing, right?
Yeah, actually, here, I'll start with the Artemis line. At least they got your gender correct. Everyone thinks I'm a man in real life.
That's because most Gunters are male, and they can't accept the idea that a woman has beaten and or outsmarted them.
I know, Neanderthals.
So you're telling me definitively that you are a female? IRL?
You should have already figured that one out on your own, Clouseau.
I did. I have.
Have you?
Yes. After analyzing the available data, I've concluded that you must be a female.
Why must I?
Because I don't want to find out that I've got a crush on some 300-pound dude named Chuck, who lives in his mother's basement in suburban Detroit.
Once again, it's very interesting what Ernest Cline picks as negative attributes. You've got a crush on me?
You should have already figured that out on your own, Clouseau.
It's like that thing that she just said to him. We could keep going, but we're not going to.
Yeah, it's all that
but
bad.
It's more arguing about how Artemis is like, no, you can never see me in real life. You wouldn't like me in real life because I'm disgusting.
Yeah.
Hippie Hobbity says, wow, that really twinks my gun.
That's great.
Also, this conversation keeps
on forever.
It goes.
Also, he says the word female so much that it makes him seem like it's some MRA shit, right? Yeah, there it is. It's real. It goes on forever. And by the way, this is the only time in this book when this type of exchange happens, right? There's no other text exchange in the book that's like
still going.
Yeah, there
it is.
Yeah. He mentions the obese man named Chuck again.
Oh, what if she was named Charlene and was in an obese?
A quote-unquote sex change operation is referenced later in this chapter.
It's great. He does that a couple of times
sensitively. Does. Absolutely.
Here's another highlight right after this. Before long, we were meeting in private chat room sessions at least once a day. We played vintage board games, watched movies, and listened to music. We talked for hours. Long, rambling conversations about everything under the sun. Spending time with her was intoxicating. We seemed to have everything in common. We shared the same interests. We were driven by the same goal. She got all of my jokes. She made me laugh. She made me think. She changed the way I saw the world. I'd never had such a powerful, immediate connection with another human being before, not even with H. Lots to unpack here. I'm glad that it's all about how she is exactly like you and likes all of the lame shit that you like. Awesome. I wonder why that is.
A cool girl, perhaps?
I love when the basis of attraction is just girl likes stuff that you like. Mm-hmm. And that she's intoxicating. And the things that are good about her and about your relationship aren't you describing things about her that she's done, traits that she had, just that she gets your jokes.
Thanks, Chuck Klosterman.
Thanks, Vice President Will Wheaton.
And Secretary of the Internet, Cory Doctorow, or whatever the fuck they are.
No, he's president. Cory Doctorow is the president.
Oh, he is? Oh, my God.
Also, fun fact. Do you know who narrates the audiobook of this book?
I saw it. It's a Will Wheaton.
Incredible.
Yeah.
All right. So please talk about the 3D lava lamp mermaid dance party.
Well, actually, okay. There wasn't too much to say about, I mean, what else was I going to say about this? I just highlight that one phrase. There was the, everything about it sucks. There's a big incursion by the Suxors, and there's, oh, here's a good passage. Artemis, so they're having a giant zero-G dance party. Again, DJed by an old man in a wizard costume playing 80s songs. Artemis winked at me, and then her legs melted together to form a mermaid's tail. She flapped her new tail fin once and shot ahead of me, her body undulating and thrusting in time with the machine gun beat as she swam through the air. Just grossly sexual. But
authors, this, barely disguised fetish.
Well, and because this leads me to what is definitely the worst part of the book, which is the masturbation section in chapter 19.
Well, okay. The Suxors invade the dance party. Og, the old man who loves dance remixes of 80s songs, kills all of them. But as this is happening, like, the Suxors invade right as Wade tells Artemis that he loves her. And yes, she's like, bro, you literally don't know me. I gotta go.
Yeah.
And he cries, and then the Suxors come in. I want to read his entrance to this party because I think this passage is so emblematic of like everything wrong with this book.
Okay.
Shawnee Boy 97 says, isn't the whole book the masturbation section? Yes, but this is page 182. I made a big entrance when I arrived in my flying DeLorean. I have to go straight for fourth grade boy voice. When I arrived at my flying DeLorean, which I'd obtained by completing a Back to the Future quest on the planet Zemeckis.
Get it? Dude, wait, Layton, I don't think you know. Robert Zemeckis directed Back to the Future. That's what that's a reference to.
Oh, my God.
I wouldn't expect a woman to know that, but...
Yeah. You wouldn't expect a female to know this. Yeah, female. We need to change woman's corner to female's corner.
Female. Female section.
The DeLorean came outfitted with a non-functioning flux capacitor, but I'd made several additions to its equipment and appearance. First, I'd installed an artificially intelligent onboard computer named Kit, purchased in an online auction, into the dashboard, along with a matching red Knight Rider scanner just above the DeLorean's grille. Then I'd outfitted the car with an oscillation overthruster, a device that allowed it to travel through solid matter.
What's that a reference to, Layden?
That is actually a good question. What is it a reference to?
That is the device from The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai that allows the Buckaroo Banzai jet car to travel through solid matter via the eighth dimension.
Fucking sick. Finally, to complete my 80s super vehicle theme, I'd slapped a Ghostbusters logo on each of the DeLorean's gull-wing doors, then added personalized plates that read Ecto 88. I'd only had it a few weeks now, but my time-traveling, ghost-busting, night-riding, matter-penetrating DeLorean had already become my avatar's trademark.
Ecto 88. See, you probably don't get it, but Ecto 1...
Little no reference.
You went out of focus. Yeah, do that. Ecto 1 was the original Ghostbusters license plate, and 88 is because of 88 miles per hour in Back to the Future.
Oh, wait, sorry. We missed an important line when he's telling Artemis that he loves her before the Suxers come in.
Yeah.
Don't say that. I was starting to cry and didn't bother hiding it from her. Is this because I told you I've never had a real girlfriend and that I'm a virgin?
Yeah. Yes, I highlighted that as well. Yeah.
The sisters come in, and then Og does his badass magic and drops the crazy hardcore line, "You jerks think you can crash my birthday party?"
You cocks. Missed opportunity to say cocks.
Okay.
Sure.
All right. Okay. We've arrived.
Hell yeah.
We've arrived.
We've ridden
the Ghostbuster
baby
DeLorean straight all the way to the best part of the book.
To the nadir of the book.
And I need you to read this one, please.
All right. Where should I start? Is it just
also,
the
Also, wait. We need mild exposition. Well, it should be... hold on. Wade, there was an attempted murder on him that killed a bunch of people, but it doesn't matter.
That's this episode of the podcast.
He decides that he's going to move to Columbus so he can like uplink directly into Oasis, whatever, because that's where the servers are.
Reliable electricity, blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
Yeah, he gets an apartment that there's nothing in it except for his high-tech gamer rig, gets like food delivered. And if you go to a pizza joint in the Oasis, you can order food and it will send the food order to a local vendor and it will come straight to your doorstep.
I know, it's crazy.
So he's living the single bachelor life. He talks about how like he was gaining weight and so he made it where he can't log on until he exercises, and he really learns the value of exercising, which just felt so like Ernest Cline, put your diary away.
Yeah. I can't write any more of my book until I exercise, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And so I would say the buildup, I think the buildup in regards to the anatomically correct... In regards to the anatomically correct haptic doll, I think is important prelude to this. I don't know if you want to read it, but... Oh, God.
I was going to start, I think, with you could also purchase.
Yes, I think that's a perfect place to start.
You could also purchase an ACHD, anatomically correct haptic doll, if you wanted to have more intimate encounters inside the Oasis. ACHDs came in male, female, and dual sex models, okay, and were available with a wide array of options. Like, why even come down? Anyway, why not just say male, female, and more, right? Anyway, realistic latex skin, servomotor-driven endoskeletons, simulated musculature, very creepy, and all of the attendant appendages and orifices one would imagine. Driven by loneliness, curiosity, and raging teen hormones, I'd purchased a mid-range ACHD, the Shaptic Uber Betty, a few weeks after Artemis stopped speaking to me. After spending several highly unproductive days inside a standalone brothel simulation called the Pleasure Dome, I'd gotten rid of the doll out of a combination of shame and self-preservation. I'd wasted thousands of credits, missed a whole week of work, and was on the verge of completely abandoning my quest for the egg when I confronted the grim realization that virtual sex, no matter how realistic, was really nothing but glorified, computer-assisted masturbation. At the end of the day, I was still a virgin, all alone in a dark room, humping a lubed-up robot. Sorry, did you want me to start reading the book? Or...
This isn't even the bad part. We have now arrived at the bad part.
We're getting to the bad part. So I got rid of the ACHD and went back to spanking the monkey the old-fashioned way. I felt no shame about masturbating. Thanks to Anorak's Almanac, I now thought of it as a normal bodily function, as necessary and natural as sleeping or eating. Diary entry. AA 241-87. AA is Anorak's Almanac, by the way.
I like that it's formatted like a psalm.
Yep. To quote, I would argue that masturbation is the human animal's most important adaptation. By the way, other animals do this too. I should know because I have lots of videos of them. The very cornerstone of our technological civilization. Our hands evolved to grip tools. All right. Including our own. Thinkers, inventors, and scientists are usually geeks, and geeks have a harder time getting laid than anyone. Without the built-in sexual release valve provided by masturbation, it's doubtful that early humans would have ever mastered the secrets of fire or discovered the wheel. And you can bet Galileo, Newton, and Einstein never would have made their discoveries if they hadn't been first able to clear their heads by slapping the salami or, quote, knocking a few protons off the old hydrogen atom, unquote. The same goes for Marie Curie. Before she discovered radium, you can be certain she first discovered the little man in the canoe. End of entry. Now,
it wasn't one of Halliday's more popular theories, but I liked it.
Yeah, I fucking wonder why. I want to say something right away. First of all, beside the fact that this is terrible and creepy and awful, hydrogen atoms have one proton. That's the whole fucking thing about hydrogen. One proton, one electron. Knocking a few protons off the old hydrogen atom. Also, you don't knock protons off. You would knock electrons off of it if you knocked anything off of it. But it's just like this is the kind of shit that pissed me off about Angels and Demons. A fundamental factual error that is easily checked. Pick a different atom. Lots of atoms. You know how many atoms have more than one proton? All of them except hydrogen. Literally any other element he would have picked has more than one proton. Also, again, it's not protons. Fucking dumb. Why, like the fact that you could do this and not think for a second, oh wait, hydrogen, that's the first one. That's the one that's got one proton. What the fuck are you doing? Makes me really mad.
Geeks have a harder time getting laid than anyone.
Yeah.
Speak for yourself, Ernest. Bro.
Insanity. Yeah.
I wonder why nobody is lining up to have sex with you when you're writing about the clit as the little man in the canoe.
I know.
This whole section.
The dumbest clit cliche of all time, right? So overplayed.
Yeah, I'm shocked that he didn't get some bean flicking in there.
Oh, yes. Same. Yeah.
When you think about within the narrative, what is the purpose of this passage? Like, why are we luxuriating on this? Artemis rejected him after he was like, I'm in love with you, also a virgin. And she goes, Sim. He's sad and alone in his new apartment. So obviously in Ernest's mind, the forefront thought of my girlfriend has dumped me is like, I need a high-tech way to jerk off. That's fine. But we keep going. Like, he needs to prove that he's better than using a sex toy. All right.
That's right. There's a good reason for it. Right.
Yeah. That he's in, and that he is enlightened for jerking it acoustic. So right. Now, when else in the book do we get an excerpt directly from a Halliday's diary other than this ode to masturbation?
In the chapter, heading pages. Right. In the section heading pages, there's always a quote, but that's it.
Oh, like reality is overrated.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. This feels, if anything feels like the, like, you know, because women were subservient to men back in the caveman days, that's why, you know, that kind of shit. That's how this reads to me, is like alpha bullshit.
Yes. And it's also doing the, like, including the little man in the canoe where he's like, I'm being fair, girls also jerk it masturbate too. Schlicking. Yeah. I can't believe he didn't use schlicking. I feel
I've never heard schlicking before.
Really? Schlicking is like the analog to fapping. Yeah. In terms of like internet parlance, that's the one to one.
I have totally missed this. Okay, this is good. I feel like I should have known that for my jaw. I know.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, schlicking. Great. Well, this schlicking sucks.
This does schlicking suck.
What's up with this twinked out schlicking Gunter? whose comment did I rip off for that? Who said it before?
I think everyone's been riffing some great shit in the chat this whole time. Right. He doesn't bother to take time to vote in the real world. I did take the time to vote in the Oasis elections, however, because their outcomes actually affected me.
Here we go.
The voting process only took me a few minutes because I was already familiar with all of the major issues GSS had put on the ballot. It was also time to elect the president and VP of the Oasis User Council, but that was a no-brainer. Like most Gunters, I voted to re-elect Cory Doctorow and Will Wheaton again. You just said re-elect. You don't have to say again. There were no term limits. And those
two
geezers...
Well, they might have been re-elected several times, right?
There were no term limits, and those two geezers had been doing a kick-ass job of protecting user rights for over a decade.
To me, that screams he wants to get on the good side of these people he likes. Right.
And it clearly worked.
And it clearly worked.
Because one of them narrated the audiobook. So there's like a new thing where anybody in Oasis can start their own TV channel that's just a Twitch stream. To prove by showing stuff that like shows how cool you are by like old anime or whatever.
Yeah.
And it describes that like one of the things that Artemis has been doing recently, she'd also launched her own wildly successful clothing line for full figured female avatars under the label Artemis.
Miss. Yes.
She was doing really well for herself. Which... Full figured female avatars. The like H is off fighting in an arena. That's the cool thing he's doing. Artemis has started big and tall. Fucking
yeah.
Husky ladies. Husky no, gamer ladies. And I'm going to continue because Wade pulls some real romantic shit here. After the night in the distracted globe. Artemis had cut off all contact with me. She blocked all of my emails, phone calls, and chat requests. She also stopped making posts to her blog. I tried everything I could think of to reach her. I sent her avatar flowers. I made multiple trips to her avatar's stronghold.
This is cool guy behavior, everybody. Yeah.
Multiple trips to her avatar's stronghold, an armored palace on Benatar. the small moon she owned. I dropped mixtapes and notes on her palace from the air like lovesick bombs. Once, in a supreme act of desperation, I stood outside her palace gates for 2 solid hours with a boombox over my head, blasting In Your Eyes by Peter Gabriel at full volume.
I mean, look, when some, Layton, you know this better than I do. When you tell someone, don't contact me again, what you really mean is, I want you to work for it for a little while.
Yeah. It's also like to do say anything where this is the 80s thing. You're just going to do the most obvious thing possible.
I know. It's always. Yes, that's right.
You couldn't have picked the moon called Benatar. Also, the 2 Japanese characters in this book.
Yeah.
Who are depicted so non-stereotypically.
And
are nothing, and, you know, have full-fledged characters outside of their Japanese, and that's it. And they care about honor and Ultraman.
But at least they recognize the superior whiteness of Parzival and how great he is at everything, right? No,
yeah.
Please, you go ahead.
No, you please take the Ultraman capsule. And then one of them gets killed. And then the other one is like, no, I must have my revenge.
Yeah. Yep.
And Wade pulls the like Hattori Hanzo sword shit on him. Like, please take this. You earned it.
You are an honorable man or whatever the shit he
says.
Yes.
And he's like, thank you, Parzival-san.
Yes.
Klein. Hey, Ernest. What the fuck are we doing, dude? Did anybody else read this? Were they afraid to touch it because it had cum all over it? I'm serious. Editors were like, I could crack this in half. I'm just going to say, great job.
Well, at one point, we should do the thing you told me you wanted to do, because I do have a family I need to get back to.
No, talking about this is more important. What the fuck? Whenever we record this show, I'm always like, all right, let's keep it quick. Today, of all days, I am generous with my time and my energy, of which I have a boundless amount.
Yeah.
Are we milking 2 episodes out of this?
Well, speaking of milking, I can read that passage again.
No.
About finding the little milkman in the milk truck.
Say truck again.
Truck. Oh, I like this. This is chapter 25. I'm jumping ahead here.
Yeah, go for it.
This is actually... he's talking. He's talking to Shoto. And at some point he goes, we're Gunters, I said, trying to fill the awkward silence. We live here in the oasis. For us, this is the only reality that has any meaning. Pretty fucking cool, right?
Pretty dope.
That's about to be fully undercut by the end of the book, but whatever.
Wade's spacecraft is named the Vonnegut.
This pissed me off because it's that, again, it's like the lowest form of like smart, right? Oh,
yeah.
Vonnegut? Yeah. Oh, deep, right? Did you know? That's a reference to a novelist, a person
who
wrote
doesn't make
novels.
Any other references to Vonnegut shit. Like he mentions him a couple of times by name. Because all of the interests here are so incestuous. This is the thing that kills me about the mainstreaming of nerd culture. It is this set pool of shit that we've decided is acceptably cool.
That's right.
And nerdy.
100%.
And it's all anime and video games. And then people who make those things only play video games and only watch anime and then make shit that is so anime-brained, so video game-brained. Fucking read a book. Anyway. The Vonnegut was a heavily modified Firefly-class transport vessel modeled after
Firefly
the Serenity
class.
In the classic Firefly TV series. The ship had been named the Kaylee when I'd first obtained it, but I'd immediately rechristened it after one of my favorite 20th century novelists.
First of all, calling it the Kaylee is like, come on, dude, what are we doing?
At least he picked another character who loves to jerk off.
Right, yes.
Yeah, I watched Firefly.
Yeah.
So did everybody else, Ernest. So did everybody else. Everybody wanted the fucking hat. Who cares? It's a show.
Unpopular opinion, Firefly was a good show. Huh? It shouldn't have been canceled.
Serenity.
That's good, too. I like that face.
Does anybody think the character who's totally coded as a child and has swords is like mega sexy, actually? Let's not analyze that.
Yeah.
Anyway, that is a build up to Shoto's vessel was a large interplanetary trawler named the Kurosawa.
Modeled now, Layden, after... hold on. You might not have picked up on this reference, but Kurosawa is a famous film director from Japan. I know.
Oh, that's so smart. My little female brain could have never come up with that.
That's why I'm explaining it to you.
And the Kurosawa, modeled after a ship called the Bebop in the classic anime series, Cowboy Bebop.
Mm.
I know that I very frequently will call something like a classic as I'm saying the title and the date afterwards. I'm under no illusions that doing that is cool. I do it because it's stupid and silly and it makes me laugh. This book straight ahead unironically does it like it is the coolest shit ever.
That's right. Yes.
DS Rockstar just says stop, 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 kill me. Yeah.
I feel like we should read Ready Player Two.
I also think that we should read it.
Because, by the way, no one likes that book. It is widely considered to be... Even people I know who love Ready Player One say all the other Ernest Cline stuff is bad.
James Halliday had taken guitar lessons for a few years in high school. That was what had first inspired me to learn to play. I'd never held an actual guitar, but on a virtual axe, I could totally shred.
Yeah, like, okay, that means you just said shred, right? In the Oasis,
he's going into indentured servitude as part of his master plan to hack IOI, and he says,
are you on?
Page 277.
Okay, great.
And he's talking about how, like, anybody who has implants are getting them taken out as they're entering indentured servitude. A dude just ahead of me in line actually had a top-of-the-line miniature Sinatra Oasis console concealed inside a prosthetic testicle. Talk about balls.
I highlighted this as well. Yes.
Ernest, that's absolutely not a joke. That is not a joke.
But it is supposed to be. Definitely. Yes.
Talk about balls. Yeah. Yep. We are talking about balls because he just said that it was in his testicle. And that's not a joke, Ernest. You didn't write a joke. You just said, like, balls.
Several references.
You know what? The only line that I actually thought was funny in the entire book, and this is a dubious honor, is his new indentured servitude job is that he's like tech support, and when he swears at customers because he's frustrated and really cool, it filters it out. And so this guy comes to him and he has a sword and he doesn't understand why he can't wield the sword, and obviously he's a noob who isn't high enough level and doesn't have a high enough strength stat to wield it.
You're talking about Hot Cock 007.
Yes.
Yeah.
How could I forget that the character's name is Hot Cock 007? God damn it, he shouted, and this is shouted by Hot Cock 007. Well, what am I supposed to do with it now? Then Wade turns to the camera and says, you could shove it up your ass and pretend you're a corn dog. That one was like, okay, Ernest, the rest of the book has been so completely devoid of humor. You can have that one.
That one did not work for me, even on that level. Nope, I'm not giving him that one.
Okay, fair enough. And then he's the super, mega, ultra cool hacker and does that thing where it's like, and actually several days before that I didn't tell you about, I had done XYZ that set me up for success.
Did you also catch all the Brazil references in this chapter?
I don't think I caught all of them, but enough to be like, okay,
bunch of them. Yeah. There's a bunch of them. Yeah, where you're like, well, but he's not calling it out. So,
that's cute.
Sam Lowry, yeah. Tuttle. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, this is just, we're doing 1984 and other stuff in that vein, buddy. That's the only part of the book that I like because something is happening in the real world. Also, this line that is totally meant to be fucking serious. They're getting to another gate and they've figured out that they can solve it by working together with the power of friendship, but also knowing the lyrics to Schoolhouse Rock.
Yes. And... they got there through a 2112 sequence, right? Where he plays 2112 and it's like he goes to the Temple of Syrinx or whatever the fuck it is. Again, this is the kind of thing most people reading this, do they know 2112 or not? I mean, like, Rush is popular, but it's niche popular. I don't know for your reader of this book on average if they are aware of what that is or not. Same question with Zork. Like, do people know Zork? I know Zork because I'm that fucking age and guy. But same thing with 2112. Do people know it who are reading this book? I don't know.
I mean, me as a Gen Z who, like most nerdy teenagers, had a big fat Rush phase, I am most, in the know, yes. Which makes me cool. Anyway, mm-hmm. Dilettantes, Artemis said. It's their own fault for not knowing all the Schoolhouse Rock lyrics by heart. How did those fools even get this far?
And also, you've got a billion people working for you, including Leet Gunters. They don't immediately pick up on this shit? Dumb. Of course they would.
The Og, the cool wizard who had a dance party and said, "You jerks aren't crashing my birthday party," because that's clearly not a manifestation of some juvenile fantasy of his.
I liked that character as a guy when he shows up later in the book. Yeah,
he's one of the only likable people.
That's right. Yes.
So H comes to pick up Wade in real life. So they meet in real life for the first time. And Wade gets into H's RV. A heavyset African-American girl sat in the RV's driver's seat, clutching the wheel tightly and staring straight ahead. Can I just apologize up front for this?
Yes, you should.
She was about my age, with short, kinky hair and chocolate-colored skin that appeared iridescent in the soft glow of the dashboard indicators. I'm so humiliated reading that out loud. She was wearing a vintage Rush 2112 concert t-shirt, and the numbers were warped around her large bosom.
I didn't check this. Do you think Ernest Cline might be white?
Oh, actually, please Google his name, because I've never seen a person done so dirty by the automatic photo that comes up.
Oh, no. The one with the expression where he's like, "Ew." That is a bad picture.
He looks like that picture of Miley Cyrus when she's really, really stoned and her eyes are super red.
That poor guy. I mean, he's a perfectly fine looking person, but that is a terrible picture of him.
Yeah.
Oof.
So the way that he introduces H is like, if you were writing a guide of like how to not introduce characters of color, good checklist. Very good.
Yep.
This is also the second book that we've read in this series of episodes where there's a big to-do made about an overweight black woman in a van.
Oh, yeah, right.
Shanita Macri.
Uh-huh. Yes, indeed.
And also, he has a moment of feeling betrayed by H when he finds out that... I got to as we continued to talk, going through the motions of getting to know each other, I realized that we already did know each other as well as any two people could. We'd known each other for years in the most intimate way possible. We'd connected on a purely mental level.
On the
internet. I understood her, trusted her, and loved her as a dear friend. None of that had changed or could be changed by anything as inconsequential as her gender or skin color or sexual orientation. Did I mention that she's a lesbian? It's dropped very clumsily that she's a lesbian and she was kicked out by her mom for being a lesbian.
Yeah, that's why they can talk about the female form together.
Mm. Yeah.
Yummy.
Oh, and so they get to Og's mansion and Wade is like, "Hey, why'd you stop talking to Halliday?" And he does like a real Dumbledore-esque like, "Wink, wait, do you really believe that?" And tells him about how actually Halliday really wanted to bang his wife, who's dead. Quote, "Even after Kira and I got engaged, I think
you
Jim
know
still...
he coded her a billion times, right?
We already talked about the sex dolls, bro.
That's right. There was definitely, this was happening.
I think Jim still harbored some fantasy of stealing her away from me, but once we got married, he abandoned that notion. He told me he'd stop speaking to me because of the overwhelming jealousy he felt. Kira was the only woman he ever loved." Mm. Morrow's voice caught in his throat. "I can understand why Jim felt that way. Kira was very special. It was impossible not to fall in love with her." He smiled at me. "You know what it's like to meet someone like that, don't you?" And then we've arrived at the climax of the book, where it's all members of the Oasis coming to face off against the Suxers. And I think you could probably cut out the, I don't know, 50 pages of this climax and just put a YouTube link to Neil Cicierega's Ultimate Showdown of Ultimate Destiny, because that's exactly what this fucking thing is. And also that song fucks. And I wanted to take a clip of the like really iconic riff from it and add it to StreamYard.
The soundboard,
so I could just pop it on. I had more fun rewatching the shitty Flash animation of my youth, listening to that song last night, than I did reading it. They're all fighting, and there's Voltrons, and they're all chanting Parzival's name.
Yep.
Everybody
dies.
On cue, the 10 Sixer avatars standing behind Sorrento pulled out their toy robots and activated them, too. Five of them had the huge robotic lions that could form Voltron. The other five had giant mechs from Robotech and Neon Genesis Evangelion. Reading Neon Genesis Evangelion, I threw my phone down and went outside.
Yeah. So you get the sense that he had like a list of things and he was kind of crossing stuff off as he got to it. Right.
Yeah. As the three of us stepped forward, preparing to enter the gate, I heard an ear-splitting boom. It sounded like the entire universe was cracking in half. And then we all died. Ernest, it's at this moment that you could win me back. Nope, never mind. So he comes back because he got the quarter and everyone's watching him and cheering him on. And then he goes through the gate and realizes that he has to reenact all of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, which he does. Quote, reenacting the film wasn't just easy. It was a total blast.
He was having a great time being the best in the world.
Then he plays a game and he wins. And then he comes out of the simulation. He gets billions of dollars and he gets like no
clip.
Which
he promised to split with everybody, of course, because he's the best.
No clip, God mode, whatever. And then he goes outside and Og's like, Artemis is waiting for you in the garden. And he comes up upon her in the garden.
With a little canoe in his hand.
I'm tired, Brian.
Yeah. Well,
Hold on.
Okay.
She looked just as she had in the photo I'd seen. She had the same Rubenesque body, the same pale, freckled skin,
Rubenesque,
the same hazel
twice.
Eyes.
Right.
Yes. The same hazel eyes and raven hair, the same beautiful round face with the same reddish birthmark. But unlike in that photo, she wasn't trying to hide the birthmark with a sweep of her hair. She had her hair brushed back so I could see it. And then, this isn't continuous, but a line he actually says, "Listen," I said, "we can take things as slow as you like. I'm a really nice guy once you get to know me, I swear."
Is that I feel like that's a quote from something specific. I don't know.
The Gen Xer doesn't understand the Ready Player One reference. I don't know either. And then there's a stupid thing about how he's holding her hand at the end. That's Ready Player One.
This guy, once you get to know me. Is that from something? Let's see. Nope. Not that I can tell.
Just his own dumb brain.
Now, whenever we finish one of these travesties, I always look at the front of the books, which have blurbs about what an amazing book you're about to read. And it's insanity. Mm-hmm. Like, is this people just trying to get their quote in the book? Is it people with bad taste? Is it people who don't know good writing? Is it people who just like hear the references and they're like, oh yeah, fuck yeah, yeah. I don't get it, but they're like
calling
well-known
favors.
Authors and stuff here. An adrenaline shot of uncut geekdom.
Oh my God.
Scalzi.
Uncut?
He mentions Scalzi as one of his favorite sci-fi authors. There's a blurb from Scalzi here. Actually, this quote is terrible. Imagine that Dungeons & Dragons at an 80s video arcade made hot, sweet love, and their child was raised in Azeroth. If you're not already experiencing a nerdgasm at the thought, I don't want to know you. Yeah. A nerdgasm.
It was a different time, I want to say, because I was like that in the year 2010, but also I was 13, so what's your excuse?
Yeah, I was, in 2010, I was 35. So, there we fucking go. Now, Leighton, you have a very special thing prepared for us today. You do.
In the spirit of the way that you conduct bits on this show, part of me doesn't...
Wait, sorry, what are you talking about?
The way that you conduct your comedy experiences on this show.
Oh, yes, yes. My extended comedic interludes, yes.
I, after finishing this book last night, took it upon myself to write a loving homage to Ready Player One, but instead of all of the cool stuff that Halliday and Ernest Cline like, I replaced it with stuff that I like and I'm nostalgic for. The problem is that I wrote this and I wrote like 2,700 words of it.
And you told me 2,000. You did not add the 700, which rounds up to 3,000.
Oh, sorry. It's 2,300. I was getting it confused with another thing. Folks, do you want to listen to this?
Oh,
I don't
yes,
know how long.
Do.
I don't
no,
know
do.
How long
we
this
do.
Is going
to
take.
We want to listen to this. Just do it.
This is called Press Any Button by Leighton Gray. Part one. And just like Ernest Cline, I'd like to start with a quote. Do you want to date my avatar? She's a star, and she's hotter than reality by far. Felicia Day, 2009. After I had easily dispatched all of the big ugly monsters that had descended on my avatar the moment I teleported to the planet Cyberpunkia, I took a deep breath and enjoyed the view. Dozens of replicas of CD Projekt Red's Night City sparkled on the horizon in the distance. With the high-tech upgrades I had made to my full-body gaming rig, the interior fans made the sweat I had accumulated from 16 hours straight of gaming in the simulation feel exactly like a cool sea breeze. My digital assistant took the form of Johnny Silverhand from Cyberpunk 2077, and he had all of the serious tood he did in the original game. But he was also programmed to do extra helpful tasks like answering my fan mail for me, laughing at all my jokes, and showering me with compliments on my curvaceous physique and gamer knowledge. I had him turned off for the time being because I couldn't let his digitally enhanced dump truck ass and constant sexual overtures distract me from the quest I was on. It was the only quest that mattered. The hunt for the ruby amulet created by the designer of Mirage herself, Schmaiden Frey. Frey was the world's sexiest and richest and most famous game developer, and I was her most diehard fan. Everything she liked, I did too, which made me very cool and really good at solving the clues she had hidden all throughout the simulation before she died tragically young by choking on a strawberry Uncrustable that she tried to eat in one bite. Her will stipulated that the first gamer to prove themselves pure of heart and fat of ass by solving her series of devious clues that only the smartest gamers would understand would inherit her lavish fortune. I had dedicated my previous 5 years solely to molding my taste in media to hers, obsessively deep diving into the media properties she loved instead of developing her own personality. It was a pretty neat way to get around developing one of my own. And it turns out people like me way better when I just parrot phrases they also know at them, like when a dog sees another dog on TV. Because she grew up in the early 2000s, all popular culture was dedicated to endlessly regurgitating all of the stuff that made the naughty Audis so great, like low-rise jeans and war crimes. Returning to the game, I pulled out my lovingly crafted 3D version of the original Pip-Boy 2000s from Fallout 1 and 2, the most aesthetically pleasing Pip-Boy designed in the Fallout series, Natch, which I had designated as my primary interface with Mirage. From the tiny screen on my wrist, I could pull up not only the in-game radio stations from each entry in the series, along with all the modded ones, but also every song and podcast ever recorded to jam to as I adventured across the land. Of course, my main playlist consisted of Radiohead's entire discography, and I knew each and every lyric by heart. I had listened to Creep alone over 450,000 times. This was a big reason why most of the avatars on Mirage wanted to have sex with me. I mean, my avatar. This is still going. I stood on the bow of my tricked out ship, which I named the Stugatz as a cheeky tip of the hat to one of Frey's favorite shows, The Sopranos. It was a treacherous journey to the mainland, but I had cast a magic spell on my ship that protected it from any harm and also made it fly and shoot lasers. With a flip of her long purple hair, my avatar entered her idle animation, hips stuck out as she lit a huge cyberweed blunt coolly and blew smoke rings into the air. I watched from the rotating third-person vanity cam as I busied myself in my HUD shuffling through my many new, unread messages from other players, because by this point, I was super popular and everyone liked me. No longer was I some level one nobody who couldn't even take out bokoblins by myself. A bokoblin is a kind of opponent, or enemy, as a gamer would call them, in the little-known Legend of Zelda video games. Just as a testament to the gaming knowledge that made me soar to the top of the charts in Mirage, I can tell you how only true gamers like me knew that the main character of the classic games is not, in fact, named Zelda. It was a really embarrassing when people got that wrong. a super easy way to find the noobs in the crowd, who everyone in the immediate area would murder instantly with their big awesome anime swords while the stupid noobs screamed for mercy. That was just a regular day for me in Mirage, which stands for the Multiplayer Immersive Rage-Fueled Gaming Experience. The rage part was a clever nod to the season's video gamers, one word, tendency to rage quit when emotions ran too high and commit violence against the console or PC on which they game, typically after being pwned. Me, I'd never rage quit in my life. Sure, I can get really upset at a game I'm playing, like when Alistair rejected me in the instant classic Dragon Age Origins 2009, just because I was playing as a Dalish elf and thus was punished for the aforementioned origin I chose at the beginning of the game, and then foolishly didn't choose a single dialogue choice in the middle of my campaign that would have saved me from this fate. You can imagine my frustration. Did the mechanical grinding our characters engaged in during low-poly tent sex I prayed my parents wouldn't walk in on mean nothing to him? For a virgin like me, that was the closest I had ever gotten to feeling the touch of another human, and I only cried for a few hours. But still, I didn't quit. I might have gone on a very long soul-searching walk after I was dumped by the most likable straight white man in gaming, and may or may not have punched a hole in the wall, but I didn't quit. That's for noobs, not a hardcore gamer girl like me. I trolled all the forums dedicated to Frey's interests and the hunt for the Ruby Amulet, and was a moderator on several of them. So naturally, I was revered as a god on the interwebs. My knowledge of the sacred texts could fill multiple encyclopedias, and I had, in fact, written several that were published. And not like self-publishing on Mirage's on, either. Like, actually for real, published on paper. I got straight A's in school and also had a photographic memory that really came in handy on my adventures. But it didn't hurt that I was really smart, too, and clever. As I said, I got straight A's in school. Usually when I came up with a particularly witty retort during arguments, people would actually stand up and clap as whoever tried to challenge my prodigious knowledge of David Lynch's oeuvre slunk away with their tails between their legs. Oftentimes literally, because for some reason Mirage had a lot of furries. Those furries and regular people all over the world were obsessed with the quest for the legendary Ruby Amulet. The dedicated people chasing after this prize needed a way to distinguish themselves, so they came up with the pithy nickname Rubbers. The people in the so-called real world who looked down on our enthusiasm used a nasty epithet for us instead, Rubes. But if any of these posers stepped into the world of Mirage and tried to start shit, they would have their asses swiftly handed to them by an army of gamers ready to gun them down with their coolest, most badassest guns, of which I have many. IMHO. Gamer lingo you wouldn't understand. The real rubes were the ones who refused to engage in life's ultimate pleasure, sitting inside while you watch anime girls with fat asses running around hitting each other with swords. Also, God... also, God isn't real. So, yes, it was tough being a part of the most oppressed class in our very real dystopia. But to true gamers like us, being a rubber was a badge of honor and way better than being a noob or a normie. Hanging out in Mirage with other rubbers was one of the few things that made my dull, boring, dangerous life outside of Mirage bearable, where at any second I could be attacked by drug-addled murderers. It was a blast just getting together in pitch-perfect Y2K replicas of Claire's and Hot Topics with like-minded gamers to watch movies, play Nintendogs for the Nintendo DS, open a million tabs of TV tropes, or argue about the riddles and the sacred texts. We even had an awesome code name for what we did together. Rubbing one out. It's pretty cool that we were the first ones to ever come up with that phrase, and we used it as a secret passcode to identify each other IRL. This is more lingo only real gamers will get. My ringtone for incoming calls in Mirage was a MIDI file of Justin Timberlake's Cry Me a River 2002. The exact same one Frey's mom had on her silver Razor flip phone when she was a kid in the early 2000s. The one proper decade where nothing bad ever happened and every piece of media that came out was solid gold because it came out when Frey was a kid. Like Justin Timberlake's Cry Me a River. The sound file overlapped with itself infinitely as my auto screener filtered out the hundreds of potential suitors trying to video call me, all of whom were ruinously obsessed with my avatar. Some of them had custom shirts and everything. And who could blame them? I was at the top of the high score list, which made me better than the rest of the lowly rubbers who couldn't even get past Frey's first portal, which had been child's play for me, like the movie, which I also knew by heart. My avatar was everywhere since I had signed endorsement deals with all of the hottest companies that gamers love, like Cheetos and Raytheon. This also meant I was a millionaire because people saw me in ads everywhere, so they all knew who I was and I was recognized and given high fives constantly. This gave me plenty of disposable income to spend on as much revealing armor and flying cars and awesome swords in Mirage as I wanted. My avatar was quickly taking the virtual world by storm. Did I mention that she's a wood elf who is also a vampire with glowing pink eyes, cybernetic enhancements, and just like an absolutely huge fucking rack? This is important to the story. In the real world, I was just a girl living in the attic of a family of five, siphoning off of their network, and also any food they left out in their trash can. I gaslit them into thinking the weird noises they sometimes heard from the attic was just a nest of rats. And boy, was I surprised when one day I found myself breathing in pesticides they were pumping into the attic with industrial fans, Breaking Bad reference. I think I only got some mild brain damage from that. And I also only got some mild brain damage from that. I didn't have to worry about it too much because shortly afterwards, the home I was living in was hit by a targeted drone strike sent by people who were jealous of my gaming skills that killed the entire family. It's a good thing I was actually 2 miles away. Casually toning out with some Built to Spill songs, like the really proggy live versions, in Guitar Center, where all the old guys were complimenting me on my sick bass riffs and asking me how I got so good when I only started playing like 2 months ago. I'm just a natural, I guess. R.I.P. to the Smiths and their dog, though. To die by your side indeed, right? Haha, that's just one of my little obscure references. Anyway, Mirage was super cool, and I spent all of my free time in it, trying to find the elusive ruby amulet that would make me the most powerful gamer in the world. But there was another competing tech conglomerate with their eyes on the ruby prize, Enhanced Virtual Interactive Life, or EVIL for short. Pronounced like Dr. Evil from the Austin Powers movies, mm-hmm. Goldmember being the pinnacle of early 2000s comedy, of course. Their CEO was a scary and ugly-looking man in a pinstripe suit and Italian mafioso hat and big cigar, like characters in David Chase's hit HBO drama The Sopranos, starring James Gandolfini, Michael Imperioli, Edie Falco, Jamie Lynn Sigler, the smoking hot Lorraine Bracco, and Steven Van Zandt. Tony Sirico, Steve Sciarippa, Vincent Pastore, Drea De Matteo, Robert Eiler, Steve Buscemi, and Lin-Manuel Miranda for 2 seconds, which I've watched front to back nearly 69 times. The evil CEO's name was Mr. Max Cruelty, and he was trying to kill me because I was too good at gaming in the Mirage. Max Cruelty wanted to find the ruby amulet for himself so he could take control of Mirage and turn it into a liberal hellscape where the only media you were allowed to consume was the Twilight books or movies, which are yucky and for girls. Not me, though, since I'm different. The end.
Wow. That was incredible. That might be the best thing we've ever done on this show.
Thank you.
That was really good.
I've got to read all of the chat reactions. I was fucking cracking myself up writing that last night. That's it was incredible.
That's very funny.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Well, what's there to say?
Reality is overrated, just like this book.
See you next time, everyone. All right.
Bye, everybody. Thank you for joining us on a live stream. We'll do these again. If there's any other books you want to see us read, let us know.
And if you missed the Patreon live stream, you can always go to patreon.com/late-and-night.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And listen to two Cox talk about Star Wars.
Yeah. Bye, Cox.
Bye.
Late and Night is produced by Brian Wecht and Leighton Gray. Sign up for our Patreon at patreon.com/Leighton Night. Follow us on Twitter at Leighton Night, on Instagram at Leighton_Night, or email us at leightonnight@gmail.com.